Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Audible is the home of storytelling, from audiobooks across every genre to all your favorite podcasts and exclusive Audible originals. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Audible is the destination for thrilling audiobooks with highly anticipated new releases and next listen recommendations to pique your curiosity and sense of mystery. Best-selling titles like First Lie Wins, or the upcoming Stephen King novel, You Like It Darker. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/built or text BUILT to 500-500. That's audible.com/built or text BUILT to 500-500. So we've talked a lot on How I Built This about AI, and today AI is no longer a plaything. It's a business imperative. Your team spends half their time writing, and one confusing email can turn into 12 confused replies and a meeting to get back on the same page. Grammarly is a trusted AI writing partner that saves your company from miscommunication and all the wasted time and money that goes with it. I have really found Grammarly to be super helpful to save time with generative AI prompts. It's also super easy to stay organized because Grammarly works great with other programs that I already use. Grammarly works everywhere you work and integrates seamlessly across 500,000 apps and websites. No cutting, no pasting, no context switching. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, everything gets better. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly to work faster and hit their goals while keeping their data secure. Learn more at Grammarly.com. You only get one chance to go public, and the stakes are high. Deloitte's free IPO readiness tool will help you grade your current state of readiness. Less than 10% of companies using Deloitte's free tool discover they're ready for an IPO. While the IPO market can be unpredictable, your company's readiness plan doesn't have to be. Don't miss your IPO window. Being ready starts with getting ready. With Deloitte's free and easy-to-use IPO self-assess tool, you can gauge your IPO readiness and receive tailored insights on 9 areas of focus in less than 30 minutes. Visit Deloitte.com/US/HIBT and launch your IPO journey today. Hey, really quick before we start the show, I have some great news for you. We have a brand new live episode coming your way this very Thursday. It's my conversation with the founder of Starbucks, Howard Schultz. We're going to find out how he turned a beverage into a destination. So stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, here's one of our favorite episodes from the HIBT archives. Enjoy. You were basically introducing these really low fares. Were these airlines trying to match your prices?
Yes, in some cases they were. And we told the public of Texas that you could fly at the lower fare, but if you paid the higher fare, we would give you a free bottle of whiskey. And so for a couple of months, we became the largest liquor distributor in the state of Texas.
From NPR, it's How I Built This, a show about innovators, entrepreneurs, idealists, and the stories behind the movements they built. I'm Guy Raz, and on today's show, how an eccentric Texas lawyer turned a crazy idea into Southwest Airlines, now one of the biggest airlines in the world. Could you just start by introducing yourself, Mr. Kelleher?
Make it Herb, if you would.
Herb?
Please.
Okay, Herb, can you just say your full name?
This is Herb Kelleher.
And you're best known as the...
Founder of Southwest Airlines.
Great. How old are you now?
85.
Okay, great. Perfect. Okay. We are very excited to talk to you about your story. Now, I'm just going to jump in here for a sec to mention that before we really started our interview, I had some time to just chit-chat with Herb, and I learned some interesting things about him, like what he eats for breakfast.
Normally for breakfast, I have cheese crackers.
And what he likes to drink?
Wild turkey bourbon.
And that he's been a smoker for pretty much his entire life.
I just enjoy the magical, mystical aroma and sight of smoke.
So how soon after you wake up do you have a cigarette?
Well, it's a nanosecond.
Oh, it's that quick, okay.
Yeah.
With your cheese crackers.
Yeah, even before my cheese crackers.
Now, for the story of how Herb launched Southwest Airlines, you have to go back about 50 years, 1966 to be exact. Herb was a young lawyer. He was living in San Antonio in Texas, where he had started his own law firm, helping clients to start companies. And one day, one of Herb's clients, a guy named Roland King, calls him up and he says, "Hey, I heard about this airline called Pacific Southwest. It flies only in California, and I have an idea. Let's meet for a drink."
And Roland came to me with the idea of setting up a similar operation in Texas.
And how soon after he sort of floated this idea to you saying, "Yep, let's do it. Let's start a company"?
It was a very short period of time. Maybe, you know, like a minute.
that fast? Wow.
No, it was longer than that. I was just joking. But within a very short days, within days.
Within days?
Well, at first I was very skeptical. But then I did some research and discovered that PSA was very successful in California, that Texas supplied all the requisites for an intrastate airline because it was a big state that had large metropolitan areas far enough apart to justify flying. And so Houston, Dallas, and San Antonio were the obvious first targets because they were the three largest cities in Texas.
What did you know about airlines at the time?
Well, I knew nothing about airlines, which I think made me eminently qualified to start one. Yeah, because what we tried to do at Southwest was get away from the traditional way that airlines had done business. So I started with a tabula rasa blank slate. And I think that was very helpful.
So at this point, how old were you, by the way, at that point in your life?
I was 35.
35, okay. So you had a family?
Yes, right. Four children.
Four children, and you've got this successful law firm. By the way, was the airline industry profitable at that time?
No, it was not notably profitable. As a matter of fact, Warren Buffett reportedly joked about it at one time and said, if a capitalist had shot down the Wright brothers at Kitty Hawk in 1903, the economy would probably be better off. And so it didn't have very great returns. It was constantly in difficulty.
So why did you even think that this was a plausible idea?
Well, I think it was the allure of doing something different, doing something that was exciting. I really always have had a great deal of curiosity. And then I thought to myself, well, you know, most of the adults in the United States of America haven't been able to fly because of the cost barrier.
It's too expensive.
It's too expensive. You know, they just thought it was business people on expense accounts. And so what I'm saying is that in terms of market analysis, there was a huge untapped market for flying out there.
Okay, so you decide with Roland to start a company, was that right?
Yeah, I actually incorporated it in March of 1967, but of course that was just a piece of paper. And we started to raise seed money to the extent of about $500,000.
That was quite a lot of money to raise, I guess.
Yeah, it was at that time, it certainly was, and we were set to go.
And what was the competition like at the time? Like, were there other airlines that were doing these Texas flights, like for between Houston and Dallas and these other places?
Oh, yeah. They proved to be our biggest adversaries because they were not exactly warm, welcoming, and hospitable.
I bet.
Yeah. We didn't get kisses on both cheeks when we announced that we intended to create an intrastate carrier. So Braniff Continental and Trans-Texas, later Texas International, really took out after us. And they kept us involved in political fights and fights in the courts. And they just thought that they would apply their incumbency and their financial strength to bleed Southwest Airlines to death before it could ever fly.
So they were suing Southwest Airlines?
Correct.
I mean, what was their argument? Why were they saying you shouldn't operate?
Well, you know, the arguments that they made in court were actually all kind of specious. And this is one illustration of where people attempt to use to manipulate the government to prevent competition. That's what they were up to.
So how long did it take you to fight these legal challenges?
Well, between the time when I started working on forming Southwest and the time we flew our first flight, it was 4.5 years.
Wow.
It took a little pertinacity.
Yeah.
And during that time, the company ran out of money. And in 1969, the board of directors had a meeting and talked about shutting the airline down, shutting the company down.
Hmm.
And I said, well, how about if I litigate for nothing and pay all the court costs out of my own pocket?
Huh.
Would you be willing to continue under those circumstances? And they said, oh, sure.
So how, what was it that motivated you to fight for 4 years to launch this airline?
Well, first of all, I was idealistic about it because I figured if they can prevent Southwest Airlines from introducing what Southwest Airlines proposes to provide to the consumer, then that is a sign that the free enterprise system is failing. And one of the things that motivated me was to, in effect, validate the free enterprise system. And another one was, of course, that it was very hot competition and I like to win.
But what's not, like, what I don't get is it was such a huge gamble anyway, because you could have spent those 4.5 years fighting and then winning, and then Southwest Airlines might have fizzled out anyway.
I'll tell you what, Guy, you put your finger on something. Because if you had taken a poll in the state of Texas after we filed our application, I can assure you that 99.9% of the population of the state of Texas would say, this thing will never come to anything.
Hmm.
I'm very serious about that. Several people told me, they said they were glad to see how much the fight energized me and that I was enjoying it. But Herb, don't kid yourself, it'll never make a dime.
Did you ever get sad or depressed? I mean, how did you keep your spirits up?
Wild turkey helped. It may have provided a little boost. But frankly, my spirits just don't get down.
Hmm.
I don't stress very easily.
Hmm.
I'll give you an example only. They had stress classes at Southwest Airlines many years ago, and they invited me to come over and speak, you know, the fellow that was running the classes. And he said to the class, he said, well, you know, Herb undergoes a lot of stress all the time. Herb, tell the class how you handle it. And I said, I don't handle it. I like it. That was the last time I was asked back to the class.
So you were going in and out of courtrooms for 4 years. How were you making a living at that time?
Well, I was still practicing law. I mean, I was doing a lot of other things during that time, which led to very long weeks. On one occasion, I was in the law office for 2 full days, and at the end of those 2 full days, I went home, shaved, and went to a fundraising dinner for Southwest Airlines. But that's kind of the perseverance that it demanded to help get Southwest Airlines started while still practicing law and doing many other things.
So what happened in the courts with the Southwest case?
It went through the United States Supreme Court and through the Texas Supreme Court twice before we could fly. And the Texas Supreme Court handed down an order 19 hours prior to our first flight.
When was that?
That was in June of 1971. We started flying on June 18th, 1971.
What was the flight? Where did it go?
The first flight went from Dallas to San Antonio, but the one that received all the publicity went from Dallas to Houston. And we were the underdog. It was sort of David versus the Goliaths, you know, not just one, but 3 of them. So there was a lot of news coverage about it, and that's the reason people paid a lot of attention to its finally getting underway.
So were you on that first flight, by the way?
No, I wasn't. I was busy working to make sure there was a second flight.
Do you remember that day that first flight took off and— Do you remember how you felt? Did you feel like, finally, this is done?
Oh, it was wonderful. And I'll tell you an experience I had when the first airplane came in. It was over in Fort Worth at American's hangar. So I went over there, and there's this airplane after 4.5 years. And I went up and stuck my head in the back of one of the engines. And a mechanic grabbed me, he pulled me back, and he said, do you realize that thrust reverser goes off It will decapitate you. And I said, at this moment, I don't give a damn. You
know? So at this point, Southwest Airlines, what, it starts advertising, it starts flying many, what was the, was it flying more than one route? Was it flying multiple routes?
Well, it was Dallas-Houston, Houston-San Antonio, and San Antonio-Dallas.
And what was a, what did it cost to go to do one of those legs?
Well, on some flights, we had fares as low as $10. On others, we had fares as low as $15 or $20. We were about 45% lower than the other carriers.
So how were you able to do that? How were you able to charge so much, such a lower fare than the other airlines in Texas?
Through enormous productivity.
But how? I mean, I'm assuming you just had a few planes at the time.
Well, we started out with three, and then we got a fourth one. We had to get rid of one airplane in order to meet our payroll right after Southwest started flying. And so we decided that we would fly a four-airplane schedule with three airplanes.
How do you do that?
10-minute turns at the gate. We bring that airplane in, and 10 minutes after it stopped at the gate, you know, it would be pushing back again. And we had airplanes that, you know, were operating 12 hours a day sometimes. So each one of those additional flights represented a revenue generation opportunity that the other carriers didn't have.
Okay, but even so, I mean, those other carriers like Braniff and Texas International, right? I mean, they were charging much, much higher fares. And it couldn't have just been that you turned planes around faster.
No, it was a whole cadre of things. You're right about that. I was just giving you an example with the 10-minute turn because it's a vivid one. In addition to that, they were by definition monopolists. They had been under 40 years of federal government supervision through the CAB.
The Civil Aeronautics Board?
Yes, right. And during that time, if they had a little financial problem, the CAB would just give them a fare increase. And so that's how their fares got so high as compared to what we were doing since we weren't regulated by the CAB.
Okay, so you weren't regulated in the same way, but I mean, but were you doing other things like paying your employees less?
Well, it depended. Initially, we were paying them less. As the years went on, we were paying them more. Their total compensation was superior to the other carriers. And in addition, when we turned our first very slim profit in 1973, we set up the first profit-sharing plan in the American airline industry. And I think we made a profit of, I don't know, $100,000 that year or something like that. But that went on, of course, to pour billions into our employees' pockets.
And your employees were unionized as well?
Yeah, we were the most heavily unionized carrier in the United States. Our low costs were not due to being a non-union carrier, since we were more unionized than our competitors were.
So you were basically introducing these really low fares. Were these airlines trying to match your prices?
Yes, in some cases they were. There's no question about that. As a matter of fact, Braniff at one point put in a lower fare than ours, which they called an introductory fare. Of course, they've been serving Texas, you know, for 40 years by that time. But in any event, one of the things that came out of that was we maintained our full fares, and we told the public of Texas that if you paid the higher fare, we would give you a free bottle of whiskey. And so for a couple of months, we became the largest liquor distributor in the state of Texas.
So, Herb, you know, if I think about flying at that time, like I'm thinking of like Mad Men and, you know, tumblers with scotch and like a glamorous experience. But Southwest was competing on price. I mean, you were not doing in-flight cocktails. So, like, what do people think of your service versus the competition?
Guy, I got a story to tell you on that. It was Thanksgiving of 1971. Remember, we've been in business since June.
Yeah.
And my sister-in-law, a delightful lady, called me at my law office, and she said, Herb, she said, I just flew from Houston to San Antonio on Southwest Airlines, and I've traveled most of the world's airlines, which was true. You know, she was a world traveler. And she said, I know you're going to be a big success. You've got the best in-flight service that I have ever experienced on any airline.
Wow.
And I said, boy, am I glad to hear that. How many passengers were on the airplane? She said, just me.
In just a minute, Southwest goes national, and Herb convinces travelers that airlines do not have to serve in-flight meals. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This from NPR. On How I Built This, we dive into stories behind some of the world's most successful and innovative companies. Everyone measures success in different ways, but one thing's for sure, you can't do it alone. Our sponsor, Atlassian, knows this better than anyone. Their team has a suite of software tools like Jira, Loom, and Confluence that power teamwork for millions of companies worldwide, like Canva. Canva, the world's fastest-growing design platform, is on a mission to empower the world to design. The company has grown from launch in 2013 to over 4,500 employees with more than 175 million people, and over 95% of the Fortune 500 now using Canva to unlock their creativity and achieve their goals at work. Such exponential growth means Canva has had to rapidly scale their internal processes and ways of working to keep up with demand. Atlassian products are helping them navigate that formidable challenge. They use Jira to power their engineering sprints, internal recruitment workflow, and inventory management. Jira Service Management is used for capturing customer feedback and HR requests. With Atlassian, Canva has increased collaboration, processed more than 5,000 tickets per year with ease, and empowered millions of people around the world to bring their creativity to life. Millions of teams around the world like Canva trust Atlassian software to support everything from space exploration and green energy to delivering pizzas and making beautiful designs. No matter if you're a team of 2 or 2 million, or if you're around the corner or on another continent, Atlassian software keeps everyone connected and moving together as one towards shared goals. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Are you sick of the same old presentation programs at work? Better presentations are possible, and they're called Canva presentations. Canva is the easy-to-use online design platform for presentations, docs, whiteboards, videos, and more. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations are perfect for any deck you want to design. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Canva is used by 90% of Fortune 500 companies. So whether you work at a small or a big company in a team of 2 or 2,000, Canva empowers workplaces everywhere to design compelling visual content, save time, and be more productive together. I know lots of organizations that use Canva to do client pitch decks, stakeholder presentations, and slides for team meetings every day. Nail your next work presentation with Canva presentations at canva.com, designed for work. I don't know about you, but I sometimes have a hard time finding just the right gift for a special occasion. Recently, I got the most amazing gift to mark a milestone on our show. I was sent a bottle filled with personalized M&Ms. And not only did they say HIBT on them, the other side had my face on it. My face is on hundreds of M&Ms. It is absolutely amazing. And it's given me an idea of what to send my nephew when he graduates college this year. M&Ms has tons of graduation-themed packaging and party favor options for your personalized candy. I love the refillable Class of 2024 candy dispenser, which arrives pre-filled with custom M&Ms. Honestly, it's super easy and fun to create personalized M&Ms online. And when people see mine, they are such a hit that they might just be my new go-to gift to celebrate weddings, birthdays, anything. Visit MMS.com to create your own personalized gifts and party favors for graduations, weddings, birthdays, and more. That's MMS.com. Use code BUILT to receive 15% off your next order. It's How I Built This from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. So throughout the 1970s, Southwest Airlines, they still only fly within the state of Texas. But then in 1978, something really important happens. Congress decides to completely deregulate the airline industry. And for Southwest Airlines, that means they could now start flying to new cities outside of Texas. You know, Herb, at this point, Southwest is expanding and your competitors are no longer just Texas Airlines. You're competing with like American and Pan Am and TWA, right? Like
right.
The national, major international carriers start to become your competitors.
Yeah.
So were people skeptical that Southwest would be able to compete in, you know, the big leagues?
Oh, yes. We were described as a Texas airline that could only be successful in the state of Texas, okay?
Yeah.
And then we were described as a Sunbelt airline that could not be successful outside the Sunbelt. There was a press conference we went into Baltimore where one of the reporters there said, well, you know, Mr. Kelleher, he said, I know you've been very successful out west, but now you're coming to the east, the most competitive part of the country as far as airline service is concerned. And I said, yeah, it's so competitive that when we start out here, we're reducing your existing fares by 60%. How competitive does that sound to you?
I mean, was Southwest at that time, were you guys already sort of no frills?
Well, we were no frills in the sense that we were short haul. And that kind of restricts what you can do. You have relatively short flights.
So like peanuts and drinks.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And then pretzels and that sort of thing. But, you know, when we started flying longer haul, like from San Antonio to Los Angeles, we had a press conference, you know, to announce a new service. And one of the reporters there said, well, are you going to serve meals on those flights? And I said, no, we're not. We're going to charge you $400 less per trip, right? And I understand you can get a pretty good sandwich at Chasen's for $400.
So at what point did you give up your law practice?
Actually, that was at the request of the board of directors in 1981.
So you still had your own law practice that you were doing other work for throughout the entire 1970s?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And I'll tell you the truth. You know, I didn't really hanker to be part of corporate life. Because, you know, lawyers have a lot more freedom to do their own thing when and where they want to. But we hired a very excellent fellow named Lamar Muse, who was a real battler, to get the company off the ground and operational.
Right.
He had substantial airline experience, and he did a wonderful job. And so, you know, finally in 1981, we lost a successor to Lamar, and the board of directors said to me, you've got to do it.
And did you want to do it?
Well, I felt I had to do it,
and
I'll tell you why, because the start of the 1980s, you had unemployment of 10.8%, you had a double-dip recession, you had the air traffic controller strike, then Lamar Muse, the guy we hired to get the company off the ground, he launched a competitor against us called Muse Air.
Oh, wait, he left Southwest and then launched a competitor?
Yeah, 3 years after he left, called Muse Air.
How did you feel about that?
Well, I thought it was somewhat immodest on his part.
Because he called it Muse Air after himself?
Yeah.
But were you like, what are you doing? I mean, we worked together all these years, and now you're, I mean...
No, we bought him later.
you bought him later?
Yeah, when they're on the verge of bankruptcy, yeah. We bought Muse Air. But it was there in 1981. So I figured I better do what the board asked me to do and come to Southwest Airlines full time.
Hmm. Was Southwest Airlines making money at the time?
Yes. We've been profitable every single year for 43 years, I guess, now.
And it must have made the other airlines crazy because they were, a lot of them have had good years and bad years, but it seems like Southwest has never had a bad year.
Well, we've had years when, you know, our earnings were down, but we've never had a loss for a full year since 1972. And we've never furloughed an employee at Southwest Airlines when the rest of the industry during that period up until now has probably furloughed, I don't know, 1.5 million employees throughout the world.
Hmm.
Basically, we looked at history and said, this is a very dicey business to be in. You know, the airline business?
Yeah.
So we may be flamboyant from the marketing standpoint, but we're going to be very conservative from the fiscal standpoint. And I established a rule of thumb that we're going to pay 80% of the cost of all of our new airplanes from internally generated funds. And actually wound up paying 100% for most of our airplanes. So we had the largest percentage in our fleet of owned airplanes of any carrier of any size.
So what did that mean?
Well, I mean, you're not taking on debt, right, when you do that. So when you get into bad times, you're not threatened by the debt payments, which has put carriers into bankruptcy and out of bankruptcy and back into bankruptcy, you know, for 35 years.
You know, Herb, from the outside, from listening to your stories, the airline industry seems so brutal. Like, is it? Do you think it's more savage than other industries?
I think that it's more competitive than other industries. And one of the reasons for that is that our principal capital assets, the airplanes, move at 540 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you have a shoe factory that fails in Seattle, as an example, you can't, within hours, transport that shoe factory to Chattanooga, Tennessee to compete there. But if your Seattle Air Service fails, you can have your airplanes in San Antonio or Chattanooga within a matter of hours. So the very mobility of your capital assets breeds a lot of competition.
Did you like that competition? Like, did you like being an airline CEO and managing all that stuff? Was it fun for you?
Well, I had to adapt myself. Yeah, I loved being with the people of Southwest Airlines. That was like a fountain of youth for me. They were so wonderful and entertaining and, you know, great to be with, that part of it. But when you're practicing law, you pretty much do your own thing, and it's a swift pace. Well, things didn't move as swiftly at first when I came to Southwest Airlines full time. And we're moving swiftly compared to the rest of the airline industry, but not compared to my experience.
Were you pushing for expansion and growth and all those things during your tenure?
Oh, yes. I mean, Southwest Airlines expanded enormously, you know, from a very small base. But I soon realized it was a speech that I went to hear. Where a guru said, if you can improve a corporation 5% in a year, that's a miracle. I said, oh, okay. I was trying to do 25%. Maybe that's why I was feeling a little frustrated. So it really brought my thinking, you know, more in line.
You know, I'm thinking, I mean, even if it might have seemed like it was a slow process for you, the fact that Southwest was growing and kind of prevailed in this industry is pretty remarkable. I mean, it's pretty unbelievable, given that, you know, so many of those early competitors don't even exist anymore. And some of the great iconic airlines, TWA, Pan Am, they're gone.
Exactly. Many of them. There are very few left.
What mistakes did they make that you seem not to have made?
Well, we just did things differently, like market share, you know, a shibboleth, supposedly. And I told anybody if they mentioned market share, I'd punch them in the nose. Because here are all these big companies fighting over their market share and losing money and furloughing employees.
Yeah.
So I said, let's focus on profitability. And if we have 4% of a market and we're profitable, that's better than having 90% of a market and being unprofitable.
What's the value of Southwest today, do you know?
Overall?
Yeah.
Oh, probably $20 billion, something like that.
So we're talking about one of the biggest airlines in the United States, easily.
And in the world, in terms of passengers carried.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it really is. It's like I've had too much wild turkey, you know, and I'm fantasizing.
By the way, when you started the company, how much did you invest personally?
I invested $10,000.
Which must be worth quite a bit today, I imagine.
Well, it's gone up some since then. But at the company, as what I thought was a requirement of good leadership, I always turned down pay increases, bonus increases, to set a good example, I thought, for all of our people. Of course, the stock that I got rose enormously in value, but that was in lieu of cash compensation.
So you were mainly paid with stock options?
Yeah, basically with stock options. I got the biggest kick out, just to give an exemplar, when I did a stock option deal in lieu of pay raises with our pilots, so they got Southwest Airlines stock options in lieu of a pay increase. I took no pay increase along with them. And I'm not trying to single anybody out, but there was the head of an airline that was smaller than Southwest Airlines and on the verge of going out of business, whose salary and bonus were three times what mine were at Southwest Airlines, and that's the way I wanted it.
By the way, like, are you ever worried that some young Herb Keller type character is going to come around and put up some upstart airline and knock Southwest off its throne?
I'm concerned about it all the time. I wrote a letter to our employees, and it was about my 10 foremost concerns for the next decade of Southwest Airlines, okay?
Yeah.
And number one was us, that we ignore competition, that we get complacent, that we get cocky. And I used the line, think small and act small and we'll get bigger. Think big and act big and we'll get smaller.
So it could happen one day.
Oh, it's possible. You know, I'm a history buff. And if you look at the largest companies in the United States as the 19th century turned into the 20th, most of them are gone. The Central Leather Company in 1900 or 1901 was the 17th largest company in the United States. But it didn't anticipate what the advent of the Ford automobile was going to mean. You know what it did? It made buggy whips and saddles. And never stopped doing it until it was gone. And if you look at countries or you look at companies, they perish. And if you have any sense of history, you realize that and, you know, try to avoid it.
You know, hearing the story of how you made this happen and all the work you put into it, I wonder if you think you're just wired differently to be able to put up with all that stuff for so many years.
Well, I think, yeah, I probably am wired a little bit differently from many people, and they're probably very happy about that difference themselves. But one of the things is that I never look back. You know, I don't spend a lot of time regretting things that went wrong. And furthermore, I think that I've always had a great deal of fun out of what I was doing. And, you know, people would say to me, why aren't you burned out?
Yeah.
You know, I was working 100 hours a week. And I would answer very simply, well, it's easy when you have a passionate joy in what you're doing. You don't burn out.
Herb Kelleher co-founded Southwest Airlines 50 years ago, and he served as CEO and then on the board before retiring in 2008. By the way, Herb Kelleher once resolved a trademark dispute with a rival airline. They were both using the slogan, "Plain Smart." He resolved this not in court, but by challenging the other CEO to a public arm wrestling match, which Herb Kelleher lost. And you can see that entire arm wrestling match. Just go to Google and type in "The Malice in Dallas." And please do stick around, because in just a moment, we're going to hear from you about the things you're building. This episode is sponsored by Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for building your brand, engaging your customers, and growing your business online. So if you're running a business like the founders on this show, then you'll love some of Squarespace's features. Whether you sell physical goods, digital content, or services, Squarespace has the tools you need to start selling online, including lots of payment options for customers at checkout, as well as easy client invoicing. Squarespace also makes email campaigns super easy with customizable email templates for converting subscribers into loyal customers. And Squarespace has tons of analytics so you know where all your site visits and sales are coming from. So check out squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/built to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. C4 Smart Energy is a proud sponsor of How I Built This. It's harder to focus than ever these days. Thankfully, C4 has reinvented the energy drink game with C4 Smart Energy, the only energy drink clinically proven to provide enhanced mental focus. Containing 200 milligrams of natural caffeine, a blend of vitamins, and zero sugar, it was formulated to support your well-being and help you feel your best, all while enhancing mental focus. They taste great, and they really work, especially after hours of interviews when I'm mentally exhausted, and I need a boost to help me get my focus back. From your brain to your body, C4 Smart Energy does it all and tastes amazing. Find Smart Energy at your local Target, in the Check Lane cooler, and where you find energy drinks. C4 Smart Energy. Stay focused. Hey, thanks for sticking around, because it's time now for How You Built That. And this week's story comes to us from Monica Mizrachi of San Diego, California. And it starts about 3 years ago when Monica's daughter, Leia, was packing to go overseas on a gap year program.
She was going to be traveling to 14 different countries, which meant that she was going to be living out of a suitcase. So we needed to find a system where she would be very organized in her travels to be able to survive out of a suitcase pretty much for the year.
Okay, if this were me or maybe even you, you know, we could just throw a bunch of clothes into a suitcase and forget about it. But Monica, she is incredibly organized.
I was a mathematician in college, and I was always very into order. Like, in math, there's one solution.
But when it came to packing?
I just couldn't find the system. We tried with Ziploc bags, we tried many other packing cubes, but you couldn't see your things. And I wanted to turn a suitcase into a set of drawers.
And what Monica came up with was a modular set of clear, squishy plastic cubes that you could stack inside a suitcase and pull out by a handle.
When you open your suitcase, you can see everything in your suitcase.
And eventually, Monica ran into a friend at a barbecue who happened to work with factories in China. So, of course, she showed him her plans.
Then he says, "This looks really interesting." And he took it to China. And he made a prototype for me. I told him I wanted clear, I wanted the piping, I wanted to have a handle. And he made the first prototype.
Soon after that, Monica scraped together some money and placed an order for 14,000 of these packing cubes. And a few months later, a truck driver pulled up in front of her house.
I thought I was getting maybe 50 boxes or something. We had a 20-foot container full of boxes. And I'm like, oh my God, what did we do?
And that was the precise moment when Monica realized she'd forgotten one very crucial detail. She had not gotten the word out about the packing cubes.
No, I didn't have a single client. I hadn't sold a single cube.
Fortunately, her son Solomon had studied business and marketing in college. And so he stepped in and he said, "Mom,"
he said, "we are going to work really hard. We're going to put it online and we're going to sell it."
So Solomon started to email mommy bloggers about the cubes, and one of them posted it on Pinterest. And sure enough, he says,
"We just got, you know, 6 or 7 orders, and like that was a big deal at the time. That was like, wow, like this is working, you know."
And he actually liked the idea so much that 2 years ago, Solomon bought the company from his mom, and he called it Easy Packing. Now, she still helps out with the accounting, and her husband does the legal work, and her other kids help out too, but Solomon, he now does the bulk of the work.
You know what? It's been an amazing honor to work with my son. I never thought I would work with my son. If it hadn't been for him, I would not have been able to do it.
That's Monica Mizrachi of Easy Packing. You can read more about it on our Facebook page, and of course, if you want to tell us your story, go to build.npr.org. And thanks so much for listening to the show this week. If you want to find out more or hear previous episodes, go to howibuiltthis.npr.org. You can write us. That's HIBT@npr.org. And if you want to send a tweet, it's @howibuiltthis. Please also take a moment to subscribe to our podcast if you haven't done so already at either Apple Podcasts or however you get your podcasts. Our show was produced this week by Casey Herman with music composed by Ramtin Arablouei. Thanks also to Neva Grant, Sanaz Meshkinpour, Claire Breen, Lawrence Wu, and Jeff Rogers. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to How I Built This from NPR.
podcast every weekday.
50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for 7 decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes from Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery. This is The Competition. I'm your host, Shimo Liai, and I was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now I'm returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that saved Abercrombie, or which real tech acquisition is like Game of Thrones, or the one financial equation that can finally solve climate change? Then check out the Daily News podcast, The Best One Yet. Every morning on The Best One Yet, hosts Nick and Jack serve up to 3 of the most interesting business news stories and why you need to know them in just 20 minutes. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies, you're going for that promotion at work, or you just want to know the trends before your friends, be in the know this year by starting your morning with The Best One Yet every weekday. Follow The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free right now on Wondery Plus, and for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more. Wondery means business.